Hello, I'm Seth Dello, and today I've come to Dorset to conduct an interview for the Marsh of Vale magazine's audio series, exploring different aspects of life in our wider local community. Aside from a few larger towns dotted throughout, the area in which we live is predominantly rural, covered by vast stretches of land with smaller communities, often a common encounter. While rural living can be a wonderful way of life, it is not exempt from problems associated with mental health. The constituency of West Dorset is no exception, which stretches from Lyme Regis to Chickerall and to Sherborne in the north. Unsurprisingly, this area is agriculturally active and also has a high proportion of elderly people. With me to discuss this in his constituency office is Chris Loder, the Member of Parliament for West Dorset, who was elected in 2019. In this first part, I will discuss the complicated issue of rural isolation and loneliness in our area, how we have ended up in such a situation, and Chris's own experience and views on mental health. Before we begin, Chris, can you tell those listening a little more about yourself?
Absolutely, Seth. So I'm Chris Loder. I'm the reasonably newly elected MP for West Dorset. I'm from Sherborne. I was born at the Yetman Hospital in 1981 and was brought up on my family farm, which is just outside of Sherborne. It's a small tenant farmer beef farm with about 140 acres. And I went to the Griffin School in Sherborne. And then after that, I went to work for the railways. I didn't go to university. I went to work for the railways and I started my career on the railway line between Yeovil Junction and Salisbury. Then I was a guard on the line after that and then went on to spend 20 years working for the railways in one way, shape or form. And then I was a district councillor for a couple of years from 2013 to 2015. That was for the West Dorset District Council, representing the ward to the south of Sherborne, which is where the farm is. The whole Brexit debate got me much more interested in politics. Although I joined the Conservative Party back in 2008 after the recession, once I regrettably was made redundant at that time. I thought there was something not quite right, so that's when I really became much more politically aware. And then after being a councillor, actually I could really understand the true value of politics. And so I decided to get a bit more interested and involved. And so I went through the selection process along with 140 others to be the Conservative candidate for West Dorset in the December 19 general election. And here we are.
What is your personal view of mental health and the situation in our area?
I do very much have my own personal experiences. So mental health in rural areas, I don't feel is given the level of attention that it should have. Often, I think we find that mental health challenges and difficulties are very much centred on urban areas and the sorts of challenges found in larger towns and cities, rather than in places like rural West Dorset and indeed, you know, rural South Somerset as well. The situation is very different, and I think often loneliness and isolation have quite a big factor to play in mental health issues. I do think, though, that, you know, when I was a bit younger, we were much more attuned and accustomed to, you know, being happy and comfortable with our own company. Or, you know, even with television or whatever. Although that does feel to me as though that has changed as time has gone on. And I think there are a number of other factors that we'll maybe talk about in just a minute. But I do very much, from my own experiences, know that it's not just about isolation and loneliness. I had a nasty farm accident when I was 15. I fell into an apple harvester at my uncle's farm, which is near Martock. And it was a very traumatic experience for me. I spent 4+ hours stuck in this machine. I had to go to hospital in Yeovil. I then had to go to Bristol, to the French A Hospital, for 2 critical operations that basically saved my arm because it had been eaten up by this harvester machine. And you know, I couldn't quite understand afterwards why I was so troubled about it. And it sort of became clear much, much later on. Only, if I'm honest with you, much more recently, really, that post-traumatic stress disorder, when you've experienced something really very traumatic, can affect you, and sometimes when you least expect it to, and it kind of sort of, you know, like jumps out of the closet and comes and spooks you a little bit. And sometimes it is very unsettling. I mean, I've worked for the railway, as I just said, for, you know, all of my career before I was elected. And, you know, we experienced many difficulties on the railway, which were also quite unpleasant. But because it didn't necessarily directly affect you, it felt as though it's much more contained, the shock that you experience, because you do experience shock when you have to deal with all sorts of very difficult things, whether it's because people have taken their own life or whatever it is. You generally do, you know, you move on from that reasonably quickly. From my experience, it's not the same for everybody. But when you are involved with such trauma, as I've just outlined that I was, the ability for that to be recognised, certainly at that time, was pretty much zero. You know, I couldn't understand why 4 or 5 months after I would find myself crying myself to sleep. Just couldn't quite understand it. And over time that became much clearer as to why. The difficulty being is that the help available at that time was pretty limited, if existent at all, really. So, you know, we have moved on leaps and bounds from that point, some 24-ish years ago, where the support available has massively improved. But the recognition of those sorts of things, the understanding of where you can go for help, it is also, whilst things have moved on, sometimes it's not an easy thing to do, and not an easy thing to almost say actually, or recognise for yourself that you're struggling with something, and to be able to, you know, take the initiative to go and do it. But I, you know, I'm finding very much in my new role as a Member of Parliament that when people get in touch with their MP, it is often, not always, but often, as an absolute point of last resort, because they're at their wit's end dealing with what in some cases can be the most saddest of situations. And, you know, I'm so pleased to be able to help as much as I can. And I would say, you know, 8-9 times out of 10, we can help find, or I can help find solutions to help people out. But there is, of course, the odd occasion where, you know, we can't, or I can't help, which is a matter of frustration and sadness for me. The reality of being a Member of Parliament, of course, is that you're here as a representative of this constituency to hold the government to account, rather than being a government minister. And that is something that is not well understood, I find. Regrettably, I don't necessarily have the ability to pull a direct string and make something happen tomorrow, but I can sort of hold others to account in doing so.
One major concern for mental health in our area is that of social isolation and loneliness in rural locations. Rural communities, especially those with an elderly population, are regarded as being vulnerable and even neglected due to digital exclusion, social isolation, and a lack of transportation, according to a report by the Local Government Association and Public Health England. Why do you think we have ended up in this difficult position?
I think, Seth, there are a number of factors that really have sort of brought this to the fore. If I just go back in my life to, you know, when I finished sixth form, the ability for me to get a good job here and the ability for me to live here was quite limited. And that's one of the reasons as to why I pursued a career at the railway that for a little while took me away from my home. I look now at the area and I see house prices to be relatively high. I see a very high level of second home ownership, which contributes to the house price going up. I see the average salary here to be lower than other parts. So for younger people to be able to stay here with their families and to be an integral part of their communities is quite difficult. The reason I just outlined that is because I believe that if I were to go back, for example, to my grandmother's generation, the whole element of family cohesion, of community closeness, particularly in very rural areas, was very, very good. It was very close. You know, neighbours would often look in on each other. The family unit was much closer. There wasn't the need for younger generations to move away. There have been many and very different pressures that have meant that that hasn't happened. Invariably, it happens better in towns, I think, than in much more rural areas. Although I have to say that one of the silver linings to this cloud of coronavirus has been, I think, a completely new approach to how community supports each other. But I think that we have these challenges, and it has meant that we have gotten to this position of where particularly older people feel much more isolated than maybe their parents or grandparents did when they were their age. And I think it is incumbent on those of us who have influence in politics locally and nationally to, you know, rebalance the economy. The fact that West Dorset has quite a high average age, one of the highest in the UK, I would like us to bring that down. The fact that there are some villages in West Dorset where almost half of all the houses are second homes. And of course that means that they're second homes, the people who own them are not there for the majority of the week. So their ability to, you know, play a part in the community, to use the village shop, to support the village pub, go to the village church, you know, those sorts of things. The things that have been so underpinning in our community for so long aren't necessarily used, and therefore that's, I think, all had a contributory factor. I've mentioned here in my own constituency, but I don't think it is isolated to here. I think it is the case across rural Britain.
In this second part, I will explore the problematic relationship of agriculture and mental health, where people can access support if they need it, and how local communities are stepping in to help. With the theme of rural isolation, one particular industry is struggling with mental health. Those working in agricultural roles, such as farming, are at higher risk of suicide, in fact, almost twice as high than the national average, according to the ONS. The reasons for this are extensive and range from stress derived from uncertain weather conditions and poor harvests to financial pressures attempting to keep up with the nation's demand. So, Chris, what is your interpretation of such concerning news?
Those who work in farming and agriculture are unique in many ways. These are people that work in all seasons, at all times of day, and in all weathers. And there are few jobs that do that. And those that do it often are those where you come into contact with other people, either that's colleagues or people you're going to see to help or whatever. For farmers, it is often not the case. You know, if you're fortunate enough to be married or with a partner and children, you know, you have your family support unit, which is great. But there are many examples of where you have a farmer on their own for considerable periods of time. And I think that, along with all the challenges that farming brings, does have its effect. Farming has many uncertainties to it, whether it's weather, whether it's market price, whether it's economic conditions. There are so many factors, and there are times where ensuring cash flow and finances are actually quite difficult. And I think, of course, there are all other sorts of matters as well that affect. I mean, this suicide rate is shocking. It is a cause for national embarrassment, I think, that we are in that situation where a few months ago, was just over a month ago it was, you know, I specifically mentioned and asked in the House of Commons what the government is doing, particularly to support gay farmers, because certainly I'd noticed, with the help of others like AgRespect and others, that actually there was a particular trend emerging from those who were single and or gay. And that is something that quite often is a bit taboo to talk about in rural England. And I think, you know, we need to be in that situation where we recognise these issues and where we're very happy to help those and support those who ultimately put food on our table. I wrote in the Farmers Weekly a few months ago about the agriculture bill and the fact that we often have many people that get in touch with us, but I had literally a handful of farmers who got in touch, and in my constituency I have some in the region of 250 farmers. You know, the fact that I had sort of three or four get in touch about something that was really important to them, you know, makes me think actually, you know, the farmers have got to do a bit more. And I've offered to the NFU to meet farmers in all sorts of different fields, and that isn't an offer that's widely taken up, but I have written now to every farmer to offer that support. I think farmers didn't ought to be afraid to contact their MP and others who are willing to fight their cause. Because I know, you know, having been a farmer's son, I was brought up on, you know, on our farm just outside of Sherborne. I know it's difficult. We went through BSE in the early 90s, foot and mouth in the later 90s. You know, one of the reasons I'm not on the farm now is because the future at that time looked pretty bleak, and I thought, well, actually, I need to do something different. That's when I went to work for the railways. So I do fully recognise how difficult it is.
So what advice would you give to those working in agricultural roles who are struggling with their own mental health, and perhaps where they could go to get help?
There are a huge number of support mechanisms. You know, for those who need support and help, please, anyone in my constituency who I can help, you know, having gone through the experiences I have, I should be delighted to do whatever I can to help. So first of all, please get in touch. But there are also, you know, other organisations that can help specifically, you know, with mental health matters in the farming community. There's the Arthur Rank Centre that's done a huge amount of brilliant work for years to help farmers. There's the Farming Community Network as well. The Church of England has a farming chaplain. We're very fortunate that the farming chaplain, certainly for Dorset, is in Holwell. And we're also fortunate that, you know, as I found from the farming community, they are actually very happy to support one another. And I think we'll find that there are more people than we realise who have experienced the same sorts of challenges and difficulties who are willing to help. So I think there's much more help and support there than we realise. It's just, as I've found, I think it's probably the difficult bit is about sort of taking the initial step to get in touch.
To remedy the impact of poor mental health on rural communities, there have been a number of initiatives to assist. Some local councils are operating a community agents initiative, which seeks to provide those in need of assistance with a designated volunteer agent, who, for example, provides confidential and practical community-based solutions to those in rural locations. Other initiatives include the establishment of village shops and local talking cafes as a method of getting people out and about and socialising. Chris, what do you think of these initiatives for countering social isolation and loneliness in rural locations?
I think, Seth, that all initiatives to counter this are a good thing. Any way in which you can, you know, look to interact with others and, you know, talk to others and share things with other people is a really good thing. I mean, there are lots of other initiatives as well. I know a number of market towns had or have like zest cafes or community groups that meet at you know, coffee shops or cafes on a regular basis. The churches, of course, also offer so much in that respect. And because, you know, almost every parish has a church that meets on a regular basis, it in itself provides so much. I think, though, that one of the things I mentioned a little bit earlier was about how community comes together. And I sometimes feel that we sometimes forget about our responsibility to take care of our neighbours or to, you know, knock on the door to check if everything's okay. For example, you know, if you've not seen somebody for a week or so or a few days, if you'd normally see them more frequently, you know, just to knock on the door and check everything's okay. I think, as I mentioned earlier, you know, coronavirus has had a bit of a silver lining to this cloud for a little while, because it's meant that we have instinctively done so because we felt a need to do so. But there's no reason why we shouldn't continue to do that. And I think we need to do much, much more in that way. When we start thinking about really, really isolated rural areas, it is quite difficult because the transport thing comes into play as well. And I think the things that are really valuable, not just going to knock on people's doors, but whether, you know, we can offer neighbours a lift to the local town to get whatever, or whether it's to go to the doctors, you know, those are things that are tangibly valuable. There are really tangible things that all of us can do to help those who are in need.
In this third part, the impact of the COVID pandemic on mental health will be assessed, exploring Chris's own experience, how people's mental health has been exacerbated by the ever-changing situation, the problem of misinformation in a pandemic, and whether there may be a future without COVID. The past 6 months have been extremely testing for many across the UK. Some individuals and families in relatively stable positions prior to the pandemic have now found themselves dealing with the stress and anxiety of unthinkable scenarios. For example, being unable to pay for their mortgage, the risk of losing their job, or even having to shield. The World Health Organization reports that the pandemic has disrupted or halted critical mental health services in 93% of countries worldwide. Did you experience any challenges during the first lockdown, and how did you cope with the impact, and were there many adjustments you had to make?
There was a huge impact for me. So I had to go through the period of the lockdown without really seeing my family at all during that time, which was, you know, it was quite difficult in many ways. Now, normally, I cannot stand silaging; it drives me mad. However, this year was a tonic because, you know, I had my own tractor out in a lovely sunshine in the fields, you know, helping on the farm. So, you know, that was very nice. But the isolation, you know, was quite difficult in many ways. And you do notice, being so separate, how actually you know, how life changes, or it feels as though it's changing. And sometimes it feels as though that there's not much light at the end of the tunnel. But of course, for me, which I know is quite different for others, for me, it actually meant a much busier period dealing with correspondence and inquiries and help for others. Whereas I know for some, it meant, you know, they were furloughed at home, maybe didn't really have much to do, and therefore, you know, was a much more difficult time for them. But for me, I was in many ways quite fortunate in that way. It does make you really appreciate the things you do have when you have to realise a little while that you don't have them, and access to the countryside in the sunshine, doing just basic things, actually are very valuable and quite a tonic.
On the question of mental health exacerbated by the COVID pandemic, there is the growing discontent on the fringes of society. One of the biggest problems facing many governments at the moment is misinformation, who and what to believe. By deliberately attempting to disseminate wrong information to undermine the public health response and advance alternative agendas of groups and individuals, misinformation has the consequence of harming people's physical and mental health. So, Chris, are you aware of this growing issue?
Yes, Seth, absolutely. I see it day in, day out. I don't think it's just related to COVID, but because of the situation we're in, it is much more relevant. I think when I watch the news and I listen to whoever's speaking or listen to the radio, I often find there is far too much opinion represented as fact rather than just fact. That alone is quite depressing sometimes, especially if there's somebody who's speaking who has a reason to paint a particular picture. When I listen to the news, I don't want the journalist's opinion. I want the facts of the matter. And then that allows me to make up my own mind rather than others trying to make up my mind for me as to what I'm going to think. I think what we're seeing now is we've seen a number of, I think, organisations, businesses realise actually there is mileage out of COVID for their business. They can capitalise on it. And sometimes it is in their interests to paint a narrative or a story that can make you feel a bit depressed, really. It is quite hard. You know, I remember, you know, the first few weeks of the first lockdown, I was at home, listened to all sorts of things on the news. It was pretty depressing. When, yes, there were a number of cases, but the number of people that were actually suffering and were suffering so much that they died from COVID was minimal. And that's one of the great difficulties that I think we face at the moment, that we can often see with COVID that, oh, we've got all these hundreds or thousands of cases. Well, actually, that number is the number of diagnoses of COVID, and that can be, you know, asymptomatic all the way through to really quite poorly. And I think it's in our interest to have a much more balanced view as to how COVID is affecting us. And we need to take into account some of those things that are indirect as well. So I think, yes, this issue of misinformation is growing. I think it is incumbent on us not to allow it to grow. And I think it's also incumbent on us as individuals to look at what's being said and actually to challenge it and say, well, where do you get your source of information? Why is the source not readily available? I think the longer we go on not challenging it, if we don't agree with it or it doesn't feel right, the longer this will be a difficulty. And I think we have to trust our own instinct and judgment much, much more than we do. The need for us to understand all of the data, you know, it's not going to be in a detailed way because that's not our job, but it is incumbent on us to make sure that we know that that data is real and is accurate. And the way we will stop that is we will challenge it.
Can you personally foresee a future without long-term implications from COVID?
Yes, I definitely see the long-term with us dealing without COVID. I think, you know, as history has taught us, especially from the early 1920s, when our predecessors, our ancestors, if you like, had to deal with Spanish flu, which was similar in many ways in terms of characteristics. They had to deal with it for quite some time, and I think there were three waves of that. And they got over it and moved on, and, you know, we haven't really thought much about pandemics for the vast majority of my lifetime. But I think we are in the thick of it. We're in the middle of it. It's clear that we're going into a second wave, a proper second wave at the moment. I think we will see probably for another at least, you know, 3-4 months that this, of course, will be around. But I think the way we do sort of get over it is that we learn how to manage it, and we are responsible, and we individually take responsibility for ourselves and our families and our neighbours. And, you know, one of the biggest frustrations I have is that there are too many people who don't take those responsibilities seriously enough, particularly in city areas, and therefore the number of cases tend to be higher in city areas. And my biggest concern is actually the rural areas of this country suffer economically because of lack of discipline in city and urban areas, which is a concern for me. I think we will get over it. I think it will be a little while. And I think, you know, in terms of the impact and implications, yes, it's going to constrain us a little bit in terms of what we can and can't do. That is a frustration to me, as it is, I know, to you know, virtually everyone. But we can manage this and we can be sensible about it. We don't need to go to parties and raves and all those kind of things. But if we look after our friends and our neighbours, we focus on the things that are important to us. We make sure our children can continue going to school, because we know what a terrible impact there was on education earlier in the year. I'm quite certain we can get through it. The government has delivered and offered one of the most generous schemes to help people. I would like it to have done more to help either self-employed or those who, you know, were just falling in between the chairs a little bit. That was quite difficult, from going from one job to the other, is what I mean by that. But they have done a pretty good job to support. And I think, you know, even going so far as, you know, making provisions in legislation that meant that banks and other organisations you know, couldn't force you to pay your mortgage for a few months, for example. You know, those are the sorts of measures that were really beneficial and really helpful. But nonetheless, I know it's a bit uncertain. You know, I hope and pray that we can have Christmas with our families. It would be pretty awful if we couldn't. But you know, I suppose you know, that just emphasises the need for us to take it seriously and take responsibility for ourselves and our friends.
Thank you, Chris, for letting me interview you today.
That's all right, Seth. You're very welcome.
From my interview with Chris, it was clear that rural locations, such as that of West Dorset and the surrounding areas, have individual and unique problems relating to mental health. Despite the seemingly challenging situation, it has been an intriguing opportunity to talk to Chris about the work he has been doing in his constituency and to hear of some of the problems he has personally faced throughout his life in relation to mental health. What has struck me most during this interview and the others in this series is that no one is immune to mental health issues, and reaching out for support is never a bad thing to do. If you are a constituent of West Dorset and would like to contact Chris and his office, you can email him at chris.loader.mp@parliament.uk. If you need someone to talk to immediately, you can call the Samaritans on 116 123. This interview, as with all the others in the mental health series, will be available on the Marshwood Vale website at www.marshwoodvale.com.